All right. Can everybody hear me all right? Thanks for coming. My name is Jim Morris. I, after, let's see, at that time, 43 years as a journalist, including 9 years here in Houston at the Houston Chronicle in the toxic chemicals, whether it's in the workplace, in communities. Spent a lot of time when I was here in Houston in places like Texas City and Beaumont, Port Arthur, places that are terribly polluted, still are. So it's a topic that I care really passionately about. And it's a topic that my new organization, which is not quite 8 months old, will continue to cover. We're based in Austin for a reason, because there's so much work to be done here with the petrochemical industry and all the problems and the lack of aggressive regulation. Kraft, who's a toxicologist with the Environmental Defense Fund in Austin, and then Andrea Gore, who is a professor of pharmacology and toxicology at UT Austin, and Cole Martin, who is a third-year medical student at UT, it's UT Dell, right?
Yes.
Medical school. So with that, Cole, do you want to kick us off?
Sure, yeah. Okay, it's nice to meet you all. My name is Cole. I'm a third-year medical student, also pursuing a master's in public health for the UT School of Public Health here in Houston. And I'm going to be applying for ophthalmology residency in the fall, but I also have an interest in environmental health. So I'll just go ahead and jump right in. Recently at Dell Medical School, we conducted a survey of medical students and residents and attending, fully licensed physicians to assess what they thought about the place of environmental health and climate change curriculum in medical education. And what we found, I think, that climate change and environmental health had a very important role in medical education and should be included. And I think more than 60% said that they wish they knew more, that they were wish they were taught more, wish that they could learn more, and had even spent time in the past year trying to learn more about climate change. And so I think we all at this conference know that human health for generations to come is at great risk if great care is not taken to limit our exposure to hazards like climate change, air pollution, unsafe water, toxic materials, and more. And that's something that you'll hear more about on this panel today. Required part of any medical education curriculum as governed by the Liaison Committee of Medical Education, which is the board that certifies medical schools to teach medical students. So why isn't it being taught in medical schools? That's a question that we're asking. And we at Dell Medical School, University of Texas at Austin, we're trying to change that. And we've started by doing a few things on a smaller scale to include the formation of the Environmental Health Interest Group, which is for students who have some interest in either learning more about environmental health or advocating or writing about environmental health so that the physician leaders of tomorrow can be well informed on the very real effect that the environment and its condition has on human health. And as we'll learn in this panel, the impact is about far more than just air pollution in kids with asthma, which I think is kind of a common misconception. It's also about toxic exposures, it's about infectious disease, it's about the increasing frequency of climate change, or severe climate events, and the secondary and tertiary effects of those climate events on human health. So, for starters, another thing that my medical school has done is we've established this fabulous elective course on environmental health in partnership with the Texas chapter of the Physicians for Social Responsibility with the help of Dr. Lisa Doggett, Dr. Lisa Walker, and Dr. Elizabeth Matsui. We, in the interplay of potential exposures with maternal and fetal health and a whole ton of other things, really cool stuff that makes a lot of sense for medical students to be aware of as they pursue a career in medicine. And that course is actually how I got involved in this field. That's how I got here to this conference. Before I took the course, I knew pretty much nothing about environmental health, climate change. And I feel like even today, I still know next to nothing. But I'm happy to always be learning. It's an exciting field, and it's important. So since that course, I've also joined the Environmental Health Interest Group. I'm currently in a position of leadership in that group, and I've been privileged to be a part of a number of really cool projects through that group around advocacy and journalism and community engagement. So right now, through the activities that we conduct, we're learning via firsthand experience how to engage with local and state and national representatives. I've had a really cool opportunity to meet with the offices of Representative Lizzie Fletcher, who is actually the representative in the House of Representatives for the district that I grew up in here in Houston. I also got to meet with the office of Texas State Representative Jane offices about upcoming legislature to voice our opinions that, yes, we as young healthcare professionals or aspiring healthcare professionals, we agree with this legislature. We agree with spending more on green infrastructure and kind of making that transition towards cleaner energy. And the other thing that we did in these meetings is to offer kind of our expertise, our perspective as medical students and future residents, future physicians. We want to be able to help provide our skill set when it comes to either writing legislation or advocating for it, representing it to the community, sharing our voice in support of that. We've also had students write several issue briefs addressed to Texas policymakers demanding bipartisan support for legislation to fight climate. We're in perpetual need of louder voices in support of greener energy and climate change and environmental health issues. We have another group of students who volunteer regularly with what's called the Avanze organization. They talk about toxic exposures in the household, especially with Spanish-speaking families, how to protect children from those toxic exposures and the importance of that. We also have students who write op-eds for local and state newspapers about the issues that we've learned about in our environmental health course. The point that I'm getting at, and we wrote and produced a podcast episode, same thing, talking about the winter storm last year. The point that I'm getting at is there have been a lot of opportunities for medical students to engage with writing projects, with advocacy, with activism, and with journalism. And all of these things have been, we've been supported greatly by organizations such as Texas Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Environmental Defense Fund, and more. So I've kind of gone on and on about all this cool stuff that we're doing in Austin, this cool stuff that we're doing at Hill Medical School to try and incorporate environmental health into medical curriculum. But here I am at a journalism conference talking to all of you. So I want to make the connection a very significant and serious role in advocating, to our policymakers, in educating the general public, in educating others of our colleagues, and most importantly, caring, providing good, informed care to our patients. And everybody in our community across the globe that we're supposed to be taking care of, these people are our patients, right? And I think that there's a little bit of a disconnect right now between, how important this issue is for human health and how much of it gets covered in medical education. Obviously, there's a ton of stuff that we're responsible for learning in medical school. I'm well aware of that, probably too aware of how much I don't know. But I think that this is an issue that shouldn't be overlooked. And I think that that voice, the voice of physicians in advocating for these things, is a valuable voice, especially because, we're informed, we're educated on how does the human body function when it's healthy? How does it function when it's not healthy? What are the things that makes it not healthy? And one of those things, as we know, is these issues that are related to environmental health. And so my point, I'm trying to arrive at here, is that I think that about this issue, I think that partnership is critical to moving forward towards better education for medical students, Because if medical students today are more willing to advocate, and I think that's a voice that's going to be crucial in the future when, you know, as we all know, we're running out of time here. And the more of those educated healthcare voices that we can get on board and that we can infuse into journalistic pieces about these issues, I think the more that we're going to be able to convey the message that we need to send to the public, to lawmakers, and to our patients. And so what I want to suggest is that all of you, you know, we're doing some really cool things in Austin. All of you are going to go back to, you know, your own cities, your own states, your own communities. And so I just, I hope that you'll make an effort to reach out to, you know, medical students if you're writing a piece, or physicians, or residents, or whomever, if you're writing a piece, and ask for their views, ask for their opinions, ask for their voice, and encourage them to be educated. And I think that if we can, again, if we can incorporate that voice in, into your writing, and into your work that you do, then I think we can go a lot further together. So, that's all.
So I'm next. I'm Andrea Gualio, and I'm associated with what I want to talk about. I'm going to be talking about environmental chemicals and their effects on health. But there are many connections to climate change and to the intersection between those topics. They're very much inextricably linked. In case I ramble, maybe you remember what I want to tell you. So I'm going to tell you that environmental chemicals are pervasive. They're present in each and every one of you, and it's. The second point is that development is a period of particular vulnerability to these environmental chemicals because we are naturally most sensitive to our hormones during those developmental periods, and interference with those hormones can have permanent effects on health outcomes. Third, exposure of an individual can lead to multiple generations of diseases. And finally, the U.S. regulatory system is broken in determining chemical safety. Okay, so let me start. I'm going to kind of tell you the story of all of those different four points. Just to give you an idea of the scope, there are hundreds of thousands of manufactured chemicals. Most of them have not been tested for their effects on the body's hormone systems, but those that interfere with hormones we refer to as endocrine-disrupting chemicals, or EDCs. And the reason EDCs are so important are because for metabolism, for reproduction, for responding to stress, for maintaining our bones, and if they're not functioning properly, we develop endocrine diseases. Now, the way hormones work is by binding to what are called receptors. So a hormone is released from a gland. There are receptors on some target organ, and the hormones circulate. There's kind of this lock and key relationship between the hormone and its receptor, and when that happens, that hormone causes an effect. And EDCs can act like hormones and mimic or block those receptors, and so that's, in very simplistic terms, how they work. The other thing that's important to know is that the brain is very sensitive to hormones. I'm a neuroscientist, and so EDCs are also known to affect brain development. So let me talk a little bit about the relevance of EDCs to you and to wildlife. And this story really began with Rachel Carson in her book Silent Spring, which was published in 1962, where she described a spring where she didn't hear the birds chirping and the insects buzzing and so, and the inability for wildlife to be able to reproduce. And that book was just an eye-opener. So we know the connection to wildlife, but that really got people thinking about, okay, you know, what about us? Because that's what humans mostly care about. And so the CDC has been monitoring humans for the last 60 years for the presence of chemicals in our body. And in a study, they've so far sampled over 300,000 people, and every single person who has been sampled in urine or in blood has chemicals in their body. So we know the chemicals that are out there in the world are getting into our body, They're in plastics, they get into the food chain from contaminated soil and water, personal care products that we apply to our bodies, and so many other sources, pesticides, those affect humans as well as insects. So the way I got involved in this was I began working with the Endocrine Society, and this actually connects to Cole's talk, because this is where a very important scientific and medical organization started thinking about the environment and health. And so I had the opportunity to be able to lead a couple of expert teams in comprehensively reviewing the evidence for effects of EDCs in humans, because it's a medical society. And what we found from reviewing thousands of studies was that from animal work, we can show that there is a cause and effect link between exposures to chemicals and the development of diseases. And from humans, we have the population epidemiological studies that show chemicals with certain diseases, particularly endocrine and neurological disorders. Those two groups also reached the conclusion that I mentioned in my talking points, that development is a particularly vulnerable period because of that great sensitivity to hormones. And we know that fetuses and infants are already being exposed to chemicals because many of these are small molecules that can get across the placenta. They're detected in placenta, they're detected in a baby's tissue or in fetal tissues, they're detected in amniotic fluid and also in umbilical cord blood. So we're being exposed at all ages. And importantly, in thinking about hormones, it's so important to have the right natural hormones at the right time and in the right amount in order for the body and the brain to develop and function. And that's where EDCs come in, even very low doses of EDCs to perturb health. So I'd like to take an opportunity to give you an example, which is the work that we do in my own lab. We have a rat model of EDC exposure, and the chemical that we've been studying is a class that's called polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. You may have heard of them. PCBs were just dumped by industry. I grew up in the Hudson Valley in New York, and the Hudson River is just severely contaminated with PCBs. And so they've gotten into the food chain. And so even though you might think, okay, they were banned in 1979, what's the problem? The problem is they're persistent, they basically never break down, and they also accumulate up the food chain. We're the top of the food chain, so we have the highest concentrations. And so in my research, we take very low-dose PCBs, put them on cookies, and feed the cookies to our rats and pregnant rats. And then we look at the outcomes on the developing pups and maturation, and we look at behavior and what's going on in the brain and also the reproductive system. And we consistently find effects of very low-dose PCB exposures, similar to what we're exposed to, on anxiety behaviors, stress behaviors, social reproductive behaviors. They cause cellular changes to the brain, and they cause changes to the LRX hormones. And those processes in rats are incredibly similar and highly conserved to those processes in humans. I should also share that there's epidemiological evidence for those in humans as well. So there's a really tight concordance there. So let me move on now to the multiple generation effect of endocrine disrupting chemicals. And to set that up, let me have you think about a pregnant woman who, through her diet and her lifestyle, even if she's healthy, will inadvertently expose a developing fetus to some of these environmental chemicals. So we have two developing cells that are going to become the sperm and the egg cells. That's the grandchild. So now we have actually a third generation of exposure. And so in my lab, again, we've been doing work looking across multiple generations, and we're seeing these same kinds of behavioral and reproductive problems across generations. The really scary part is that even if you go to the great-grandchild, which was never exposed directly to chemicals, we also find dysfunctions in endocrine and neurological function. And that's because when those sperm and egg cells were exposed, so we have to keep the generation straight, but when those cells were exposed, their DNA is affected in a way that could be transmitted across generations. They're not mutations, so when we think about mutations, every piece of DNA, every gene is a sequence of molecules, and that sequence isn't affected by EDCs at these low doses. Rather, it's how these genes are functioning and how they're interacting with other proteins and how they're being modified. And we've discovered, we and others. So, in fact, in my lab, we have just published a study showing that we can see effects on behavior up to six generations later. These modifications are called epigenetic modifications, just to keep that word in. Okay, so finally, let me talk a little bit about regulation. And, of course, I've already given the example of PCBs. They were banned, but we're stuck with them. And I think that illustrates how critical it is to have good regulation, because what if we're making the next PCBs today and they're not being properly regulated? They're getting into the environment and affecting us, and then many generations down the line. And, of course, I'm sorry to say that this is happening. A really good example are what we call perfluorinated chemicals. We often abbreviate them as PFAS, PFAS. Those are used in nonstick coatings and firefighting foam, but they're just kind of out there, and they are being phased out, which sounds good, but they're called forever chemicals. And I think that word really resonates with the fact that they're going to be with us forever, just like the PCBs have been with us forever. And they're not banned in this country. They are banned in the EU. But they're not banned here. The U.S. process of banning, it basically is impossible to ban anything once it's out on the market. The way these chemicals are regulated in the first place is that because they're not intentionally being introduced into food, they're not regulated by the FDA. So there is a regulation that is almost entirely done within the chemical industry itself, where if they produce a chemical, they need to do testing. They can either do it in their own offices, or they can contract it out. But the bottom line is they're regulating themselves. And so they can come out and say, you know, we tested these chemicals at these doses. Yes, they were toxic, but below these doses, they're not toxic. So they say it's safe. And I will put safe in quotes, because I don't believe any of these chemicals are safe. And one of the biggest problems is that the doses of EDCs we're exposed to are very low doses, and they don't fall in the range of regulatory testing. Yet, we know that at those doses, they have biological and physiological effects. So this is a really problematic regulatory system that basically, in my opinion, doesn't exist. And the other thing that happens is what we call regrettable substitutions, where one chemical is swapped out for another. That happened with bisphenol A. Now, you've all heard of BPA. You go to the store, you see, and it was probably another similar chemical that was not tested and won't get tested until scientists figure out what's in the plastic, because the company doesn't need to tell you. And then we're doing another post-mortem before they get on the market. I think journalists can play a huge role in communicating this, and I've worked with some journalists on these subjects. We need to let people know, and I think policymakers on both sides of the aisle, when they hear their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren are going to be sick, they listen. So I think I'm out of time. I won't reiterate my take-home messages, but we'll all have questions later on, so thank you.
Hi, Aline Kraft. I am a senior director at Environmental Defense Fund. I manage our climate and health initiative at the organization, and it's interesting to talk about DDT because EDF was founded over 50 years ago, actually, and our very first issue was about DDT. There was an effort in New York to ban DDT, and essentially what happened is the regulators did not want to ban it because it was an effective essentially, scientists went, they garnered so much attention across the country that they used that momentum and actually incorporated it. And so that's actually how EDF started, was by scientists. So when I had just gotten hired out of graduate school and that I was going to clean up the Houston Ship Channel, and I remember he laughed hysterically because he knew that I obviously had no idea what I was up against or what anybody was up against. And over the years, I've been with the organization almost 15 years, and I think, you know, if you are a toxicologist, Texas is a great place to be because there is so much opportunity to study issues related to toxic compounds, to try to identify solutions, and if you are able to implement a successful solution, it's oftentimes, you know, one of the best things that you can do to show in a politically divided country that if there's a solution that can work in Texas, honestly, it can really work anywhere. And so we really focus on trying to find those for our most pressing environmental issues. We have done quite a bit of work around the unconventional oil and gas drilling and development and trying to understand more about the risks associated with oil and gas development. It's interesting that, you know, the tagline for a lot of the risks or perceived risks from oil and gas development has been fracking. But, you know, in most cases, the processes that create the most risk are actually not the fracking itself, but it's transport of compounds and so forth to those drilling sites. It's the potential for the produced water at the end of the process to be spilled, the trucks and the pollution generated from building out those development sites. And so the drilling and many of those areas are areas with which we work. We're probably most, I think everyone's probably aware that methane as a climate pollutant is 84 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And so in order for climate pollution, tackling methane is a key strategy. And so actually you'll see, I don't know the timing exactly, the date, but either by the end of this year or early next year, we're going to be launching a satellite that's going to be capturing the most geographically resolved methane measurements that have ever been collected. And part of the reason for that is to collect information about methane concentrations and to use that as a platform to try to adopt different types of solutions to mitigate that methane release. And so there are a lot of pollution and capture that methane that can have conventional oil and gas drilling operations. So in terms of the health risks associated with unconventional oil and gas development, really the primary agencies or organizations that have been funding work to look at that have been NIHS, and then most recent work was looking at health distance on pregnant women and using geographic distance, in terms of how far away they were exposure from that oil and gas site. And so some of the most, but because you're using that as a proxy and not using that as the primary exposure in terms of actually measuring the pollution at that location, a lot of the evidence around adverse health outcomes as related to exposures related to unconventional oil and gas drilling is indirect.
And so there's a lot of effort to try to figure out, okay, well, what are the direct measurements that we can start to get evidence to date is really around proximity to those oil and gas sites and low birth weight. Obviously, there are a lot of risks with low birth weight, and that's been one of, I would say, the easier health outcomes to study, in part because there have been birds, and they were looking at a study that came out of California that occurred within 10 kilometers of a drilling site, and then those that were not controlling for things like socioeconomic status and maternal education, other factors that might influence that, and did find a 40% babies up within that 10-kilometer distance. So that's some of the, I would say, strongest evidence. There's also a lot of work underway that is being supported by NIHS, looking at stress, looking at noise. All of those risks can contribute to adverse health outcomes in different ways. They're sort of health another adverse health outcome. And so it's important to try to have, and that's where actually HEI is trying to understand more directly what are those exposures as related to oil and gas development, and figuring out how you can make more direct measurements and potential to drilling, stronger evidence. Looked a lot at chemicals that are in produced water. My colleague, Dr. Danielle Danforth, or Dr. Chloel Danforth, is in the audience. And we've been looking at the fact that in the produced water, so the water that comes as a result of the drilling process, there are literally thousands of compounds in the produced water. And the majority of those compounds, there is no information that you could use to make a toxicological risk assessment. So we are creating almost a trillion tons of produced water annually and doing various things with it. Some of it's going into deep injection wells, but some of it is actually going into surface waters at some point. Some of it's being used for beneficial effort to try to understand what are the consequences of putting that produced water back into the water system. There was actually an article in Science just last year looking at the fact that since fracking has accelerated the waters across the United States. That's a very important finding, and I think it would be something that we need to address moving forward if we are changing the salt content of our surface water. That can be very damaging for any number of reasons. So just in terms of, you know, tying it all together with climate and health, it's wonderful to have this opportunity to talk about some of the efforts that we are making to help establish that link between health and climate. We do feel like there needs to be something to bridge the gap between what we're seeing on the environmental health side versus what medical healthcare providers, the information that they're getting in their training. And so Dr. Lisa Walker has helped to build the key projects that were is ongoing is a project with University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center, where we're actually putting together materials and information that is being used as part of a continuing medical education credit training program. So actually, healthcare professionals can receive CME credits by learning about some of the climate and health and the special vulnerabilities that we know exist across the system. So one of the things about climate and health issues is that oftentimes the communities that are most impacted are least well able to manage those risks. And so really looking at those disparities, those environmental justice issues, disparities. And then I would say another element of the work that we do is really we do that through our One Breath Partnership work, and Dr. Alan West is here today as well to talk, and is available to talk about the efforts that we've made to try to raise more awareness. I'm sure many of you have seen the work of One Breath Partnership, and really looking at the lived experience and recognizing the true impact that all of these environmental health issues have on communities all around this country. So excited to be here, and we'll turn it over to Jim.
Thank you. Let me just start with a couple of quick questions, then I'll open it up for everyone. This one is for both Elena and Cole. And that is, in my experience, as I mentioned, I worked here in Houston in the 90s, all of the 90s, did a lot of reporting on toxic chemicals. And at that time, I found it very hard to get physicians to go on the record, especially local ones, you know, about some horrendous situation on the ship channel, you know, where people were being inundated with benzene or some other toxic chemical. I'll just throw this to both of you. Do you see any change on the part of, are more physicians willing to speak out and not get them to go on the record?
That's a great point. I mean, I would say the best example that I can share about the forward progress that I've seen is that the city of Houston just last year actually adopted a benzene action plan. And what that means is that previously there has not been essentially a disaster like the ITC fire past the 3-year anniversary of that event. You get concentrations that are extremely high in the ambient air of compounds like benzene, but there's no guidance on should you issue a shelter in place, should you evacuate the community, you know, should you close all the doors and windows. I mean, there's not a lot of information about what to do in that case. Again, some of the work that we did at EDF was actually going through and doing an analysis of all the toxicological data as related to benzene and developing that decision tree that has now been adopted by the city of Houston. And that was actually adopted through Dr. David Purse, who emergency response and the health professionals who were having to respond. No one wants to get a call from a school that's burning across the street. And as many of you know, having worked in Houston, I reported on Houston, there's no zoning here. And so that situation of having a facility across the street from a school is not the exception. It's the standard and the norm. Build a school, and obviously that's going to be in places that are heavily industrialized in most cases. And so we end up with those kinds of issues.
Cole, are future physicians being encouraged to speak out more?
Yeah, the shift towards more willingness to speak out. And I think, you know, back when you were having this issue, and maybe you still do, unfortunately, climate health, you know, climate change and these environmental health issues are all so heavily politicized. And I think that probably would be at least one of the reasons that physicians are afraid to speak out. They don't want to, you know, offend patients. They don't want to, you know, put their professional image at stake. But I do think, you know, I think it's evidenced by, you know, some of the things that I talked about that are going on at Dell Medical School and also in the larger community that was formed at the University of Colorado Anschutz School of Medicine, where after completing their residency training, physicians can go and receive additional training on climate health and advocacy and so forth. And we currently work pretty closely with one of those physicians at our school. And so I think that slowly but surely these issues are making their way into our education, and they're becoming more regarded, you know, they're less regarded as political issues and more regarded as these are health issues that affect our patients, you know, regardless of where they come from or what their beliefs are. And it's our first responsibility as physicians to stand up and speak on those issues and advocate for the health of our patients.
The regulatory system for chemicals being broken, and I know a little bit more about the EPA than I do the FDA, but is there any sign of progress? And if there isn't, Is there any alternative to this, you know, this excruciating chemical by chemical system we've had in place since, what, 1976?
No, it's probably not going to change a lot. I can tell you how I think it should change, because right now it's a one chemical at a time kind of regulatory system, but we know that's a big step to just, like in the case of bisphenol A is a good one, because the replacements are bisphenol A, and we know bisphenol A is an endocrine disruptor. We now know, because there's been research, bisphenol S and a couple of the others are endocrine disruptors. Why don't we just assume they're all endocrine disruptors? And then we can start to look for other paths for trying to make plastics, because we're never going to get rid of plastics. I have plastic in my house. But, you know, let's look for chemicals that have different structures. The EU is doing a slightly better job.
Families more than...
Well, at least recognizing that the what the U.S. says is there's no safety margin, as I said, anyway. But they are progressively lowering the amount that people can be exposed to. So that's good.
Right. All right, I'm going to open it up. I was told to make sure SEJ members get first crack. So open it up. Please identify yourself and your affiliation. Mark?
Hi, my name is Mark Walding. I'm a reporter with ProPublica. This is mainly for Dr. Gore, but I love anyone's opinions. First of all, my sister-in-law is due this week, so thank you for scaring the shit out of me. I love him regardless. I reported on fence line communities next to, you know, insert any industry here, and they can always go out and find someone with asthma, right, or find someone with cancer or what have you. What are there tips you give though for when it's potentially impossible to make that 100% linkage between the thing and the effect? What we as journalists who are not doing this in a totally scientific manner, what we should be looking for, or how we should be approaching. And secondly, you know, especially a place like ProPublica, where sometimes we do, you know, science adjacent, you know, I'm right now considering whether or not we should deploy radon detectors for a story I'm doing and try to kind of make our own data on whether or not there is cumulative radon or, you know, chronic radon exposure in the community I'm reporting on. Any tips, you know, in an area like that where there might be a dearth of information and dearth of data, how we should approach that?
Question. Because the cause and effect issues in humans can be drawn with high dose exposures. So a good example was a chemical factory explosion in Italy back in like the late 1970s. That it's called Sebazo, so toxic, but also at lower doses are considered to be endocrine disruptors. And the people who lived there and people from around the world converged to study those populations to try to get a better handle of cause and effect. And so those kinds of things, pregnant women were exposed, and children, and elderly, et cetera. And now they're following them across generations. But in general, we can't do cause and effect in humans for a couple of reasons that are some, in part, ethical reasons, right? We're not going to do the experiment. Here, I will leave out is that the cause and effect from the animal models are so incontrovertible. There are so many pieces of data now showing that cause and effect relationship. And I, of course, best know the developmental exposure literature. Maybe I can address your pregnant sister-in-law also at the end of this. But that data is so strong. The only doubt that is out there about those data are the manufactured doubt from the manufacturers. So I don't think there's any controversy. It's a manufactured controversy. Trying to use those data together with the epidemiological evidence, which is also getting stronger and stronger. Helena mentioned the NIDHS, and they support a lot of epidemiological studies that are getting bigger and bigger, these population studies. And when you look at how hormones work in the body and what those hormones are, many of those hormones. So I think even though there's an element of uncertainty, I'm not uncertain about the effects of endocrine disruptors in association with these disorders, including diabetes and obesity and thyroid disease and reproductive disorders and neurological disorders, which, by the way, are all increasing over the last 50 years, which tells you that they're environmental disorders, right? Because we don't evolve over 50 years. Our generation time is like 20 years. So we always have margins of error anyway, except imperfect, with 99% probability. But I think we're very certain about those data. There was one other part to your question. Monitoring radon. I can't really speak to that. I think when we have an idea that there's something new out there that might be a problem, I think that the people who are doing the research there just need to start over with both. And I think they need to look both at the populations, but also do some basic research to try to get at that, and not to draw a conclusion too quickly. May I address your sister-in-law?
Sure.
So, because I know it's so scary. We're all inevitably exposed to endocrine disruptors, but somehow the species has continued to survive. There may be a little hype about that somehow humans are going to, go and protect ourselves. So we may not be able to move, but we can wash our fruit and vegetables. We can try to avoid eating meat and fish and poultry that have hormones. I know it gets expensive. I know that creates, the disparate impact of these environmental factors. But, we can do our best and we can advocate don't micro or making that more of a regular part of our food chain in the schools and so on. Don't microwave in plastic. I just got my little metal cup. Anyway, try not to use disposable plastics. Those are a huge problem in so many ways. They leach into the chemicals leach into the water. But we also, even if we say we are recycling them, we're not really recycling them. So there are some lifestyle changes that have been shown to actually make a very big difference.
For transient communities, not even communities that are necessarily homeless, but that tend to move often, like trying to trace health impacts in the environment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really hard one. I feel like that's one of the challenges in terms of, for example, the cancer registry and the cancer cluster work. Base incidence of cancer in a particular, usually it's a zip code. Well, you're not accounting for all the people that perhaps grew up in that area but then moved because they're not in the analysis. And so, in my mind, I think we would have a lot more information about someone's life history. Policy pieces, I think, is going to be essential for doing the kind of work that needs to be done to really get to the bottom of some of these questions, is health no matter where they are, so that you can actually do an assessment or evaluation without having to worry about understanding what the value of that, I think it's something that's really prohibiting us from getting a lot more information about a lot of the exposures. The NHANES database, which is the biomonitoring, I think is really interesting. I think blood and urine samples, that's done every single year, in terms of what is seen in our general population. And that's frightening, honestly, if you read the report. I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds of compounds. So, yeah, there's not really a good answer to your question, but I think that is one of the reasons why there are not more established connections between some of those exposures and some of those health outcomes.
Yes, and name and affiliation.
Natasha Gilbert, and I'm a freelance journalist. I just wanted to follow up on the previous question. How much evidence do you need to be able to say that something is causing a problem? And how does that come about? Is it like a consensus within the environment, within the scientific community, or is there kind of, a specific level that it needs to get to? And do you need to be able to sort of say or have do studies or have evidence to show what the safe levels of exposure are before you can take it to a policymaker and say, this is causing a problem?
Well, can I take a first crack at that? So basically, when you're trying to establish causation, there are three lines of evidence that are generally looked at. One is the epidemiological evidence, and that's the evidence in people. You know, you're looking at big populations with exposures. What are the outcomes? Dealing with the confounders, obviously. The second line are the animal models, which we heard about, and looking at, okay, what do we see in animal populations, knowing the given dose and dose response functions and curves and so forth. And then there's the mechanistic evidence, which is, okay, we are seeing this. We think that there is some evidence. So this receptor is binding to this ligand, and it's causing this outcome. And so generally, for something to say, to establish causation, you need to have confidence in those three lines of evidence. Where we see, where we have the most information, for example, in this country, we regulate, we have national ambient air quality standards for six pollutants. We do integrated science assessments, ISAs, for each of those six criteria air pollutants. In that integrated scientific assessment, they assess the epi studies, the animal data, and the mechanistic data. They evaluate all of that. And then in the report, they make a recommendation of, is there enough evidence to suggest that this is causal? And it, sometimes that's for which there is, you know, yes, causal. There are very few compounds for which there is, you know, unequivocal evidence that this is causal. But having those three lines of evidence is very hard to get unless you've got lots and lots of scientific evaluation of that particular compound, which is why we don't have more information about, you know, the causal nature of some of those compounds, because we're lacking the dearth of evidence. And the reason is that there's so many compounds that when you think about the epidemiological analysis, the mechanistic work, and then the animal work, obviously, it's a huge obstacle to try to understand all of that together.
May I follow up? Is this on?
Yeah.
So that was perfect, and I had not really talked about the mechanistic studies, but that is the third leg, and that was part of those enormous Endocrine Society scientific statements about these chemicals being endocrine disruptors. The other approach that's starting to happen for endocrine disruptors followed from some work that was done for carcinogens. It's easier to know that something's a carcinogen because you have an outcome that is cancer. Whereas with an endocrine disruptor, you might need to wait 30 years to see if the outcome is going to be obesity or diabetes or infertility. You know, a child exposed to something, you're not going to know if they're infertile until they're trying to have a baby. So that is the approach of looking at what they call key characteristics. And there was a paper published with Michelle Libero as the lead author. I was characteristics, where really if you met any one of these things for a chemical, you would begin to make the assumption that it was an endocrine disruptor. And that included the family play many important roles in the endocrine system. And so that there's no causality there. If you don't mind also, I wanted to react to some things my colleague said. First, when you were talking about the chemicals in unconventional oil and gas, there has been some work doing mass spectroscopy to try to figure out what some of those chemicals are from the endocrine disruptor perspective. And many of those chemicals are endocrine disruptors. That is incredibly heroic work because you don't know what's in there, so you don't know what you're looking for. And I also wanted to add, because I've worked so much with the Endocrine Society, that they've come out with information for doctors and patients about endocrine disruptors that they're trying to disseminate to get the word out more to physicians. So that way, you know, in a wellness visit, a physician can ask somebody, do you drink out of plastic water? Where do you get your water from? You know, are you eating processed foods versus fresh foods? Do you wash your fruits and vegetables? So.
We've got about 10 more minutes, so Randy,
an invited speaker for Cole's group back in October. Really enjoyed it. Anybody who's ever covered a local toxics controversy, a plant getting a permanent renewal or something, has probably run into the situation where you might have one set of scientific sources pointing out exactly with toxicology, et cetera, why this is a bad thing. I might be talking about the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality just about the college section. Well, I might not. But is there an easy checklist for a reporter? Is that some kind of guidepost for figuring out which is good?
Well, I could give an example, which has obviously been in the news recently, with ethylene oxide, right? And the controversy between the state environmental agency having done its own risk analysis on ethylene oxide and coming up with a value that is much less health protective than what EPA has recommended. And so battling it out in the, you know, scientific literature, models mostly about what is this dose response curve, when do you start seeing an effect and so forth, and also the actual papers that are selected to do such an evaluation. In the case of benzene, for example, and how current those assessments are, how regularly they're updated. So one, I can just give like a handful of things that result in that discrepancy. Sometimes the agency won't look at all of the scientific literature, and they'll throw out a paper for sometimes not a very good reason. You can't be as sure of the conclusion. Another thing is the way that they fit the dose response curve to the data is one of the things that leads to a discrepancy as well. And then, you know, sometimes they'll establish a methodology for determination of a specific inconsistency in how that process is done internally. So what we found is that generally Texas is less protective than either, you know, EPA IRIS values or health thresholds, and so it can be tricky. The other thing that important to note about Texas is that when they develop a threshold, it is a guideline, not a standard, and so they are not under any legal obligation to take any specific action because of an exceedance of such a guideline. And I, to date, I have not seen a single time where they have said, oh, well, even though there was an exceedance, even, you know, exceedingly high numbers, they have never seen a time when an exceedance would lead to some specific action on their part, which I find problematic, just conceptually.
I need to talk about thresholds for a minute, because finding a threat, and this gets back to your question, actually, finding a threshold means you're looking for some sort of adverse outcome. And so you start out at some dose, and you're looking at some endpoint, like you're giving it to rats, and do they get cancer, or do they die? So usually it's something really obvious toxicity. And they work their way down to some low dose, below which they go a little lower, and they don't find that adverse outcome. So they go, okay, this is the, so forth, they think it's the lowest observed, you know. So then they come up with some margin of safety, like let's go 100 times lower because then we're going to for sure be safe. And that becomes the threshold. The problem is that's because you're looking at some really obvious endpoint that happens easily in the lab. And what they're not looking at are things like, are you going to get diabetes 20 years later? Are there changes to your nervous system so that when it develops, you're going to get ADHD? And those happen below the threshold that is set for toxicity. And so we need to differentiate between those kinds of thresholds. And when you're talking about hormones and endocrine disruptors, you are so low in that range that there are people who believe there actually is no threshold, that any exposure at all can cause a change. And there's experimental evidence for that. I don't really spend an hour talking about it, but apply to real-world chemical exposures that we have. And other kinds of exposures like air pollution and those sorts of things.
I think we have time for one more. Say, Ken?
Thanks, Madam. About 10 years ago, I wrote a story for Nature about non-monotonic dose response curves, and I just found it fascinating just to follow up on what you've been talking about. You know, it's not only a problem of not looking for subtle enough health effects, it's that sometimes the dose response curves can be inverse U's and all kinds of weird shapes. And so when we think we've reached a moment where we don't have to worry, maybe we should be looking lower to look for these weirder effects. So I just wonder, since it's been so long since I've written about this, is there much new on this, and is anybody doing anything about these weird curves, or regulating on them,
or even any real acknowledgement of these non-monotonic dose response curves, response curve, and that is exactly as an endocrinologist is what I expect. But unfortunately, the regulators and people who don't have that kind of training, they don't even understand why a curve is, not a straight line. So they just assume there was some sort of weird problem and they ignore it. But it's well accepted in the field of endocrine disruptors that these non-monotonic curves are the norm.
All right, maybe one more quick one. Yes.
Hi, I'm Emily Dowdle with Investigative Post. We're in Buffalo, New York, and while we don't really deal with hydrofracking itself because it's banned, we do deal with the effects of disposal of flowback water coming from other states. And I was just curious if I were interested in trying to dive into flowback water disposal and kind of where it's ending up. It was like, are there any sort of documents or records that would be helpful in bugging out where they're coming from? Where
it's
how much there is, and where it's ending up,
and
what communities.
I can do after that. Dr. Chloe L. Danforth would be happy to
look at how these things are generated and disposed, and most of it's going to, 90%, but not all of it.
And it depends where you are in the country, too, because not every location is amenable to deep well injection, and so that's where you have this issue of this beneficial reuse, because they don't want to truck it somewhere super far away, right? And so it's like, well, let's just spray it on a corn field or a cotton field, and it's like, wait a minute, but this is not tested, capacity to test or treat that kind of water. And so I feel like we violate the what I think of as a precautionary principle all the time with regard to these toxics. We assume sort of like, innocent until proven guilty, and it's like on a public health, concern, it should be the opposite, right? You are assumed guilty until you're proven innocent, and that's the exact opposite of how we see the regulators operating in most cases, so. I think that's one of the challenges that we need to, as we get more information.
Right at noon, so thank you to the panel, and thanks to all of you.